Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thanks again for joining us for another edition of Midrats at a little bit different time for this week, so we can try to meet all of our guests' busy schedules. Just to give you a quick heads up, we're going to be going for a 90-minute format today. We're going to have two guests. Our first guest for the first 30 minutes will be Lieutenant Ben Coleman, United States Navy. He's a founder of Disruptive Thinkers and a few other good things we're going to get into. And he'll be with us for the first half an hour. Second half of the hour, we're going to ship uniform types, and we're going to go to Major Carl Skin Forsling, United States Navy. And he's going to be on to discuss an article he wrote recently and some broader issues as well about what many are seeing as a certain veteran entitlement spectrum and how we are relating to our civilian counterparts. We'll be getting into that at the top of the hour. Until then, I'd like to welcome to the show Ben Coleman. Ben, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Sal.
Really appreciate you taking time this evening or this afternoon, depending on which time zone you're in right now. I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with some of the work you've been doing kind of as a side job, for lack of a better description. But if you could please take a minute to describe, that those may not be very familiar with it, what is the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum? What is its purpose, and what is your role there?
Absolutely. So the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum is a 21st century take on the Standard Defense Conference. A couple of years ago, my friends and I started a group in India called Disruptive Thinkers, and I hopped on Twitter to kind of take part in the conversation. And we saw some pretty interesting discussions happening that were spanning the gamut of national security problems, really talking, you know, across rank, across the services, between military, civilian entities. And there was these really robust discussions happening, and friendships were being formed through these relationships, you know, 140 characters at a time, and a lot of these folks had never met each other. And around the same time, I had become enamored of the TED movement, basically 20-minute videos that kind of explored different things around the world. A couple of us were thinking, what if we brought those folks who were on Twitter having these robust conversations in the same room together into the TED-style engagement, while also allowing them to pitch some of their ideas that they have to senior military leaders and see if they could get traction. And so we started to develop this concept, and through the first Defense Entrepreneurs Forum last year with the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and then evolved to this year, kind of taking some of the lessons learned from the first iteration and really creating an incredibly dynamic two-and-a-half-day event in a non-military site in a very unique environment to really bring deckplate ideas to the fore and link them with senior leaders who could actually take action on their ideas.
Well, let's talk about some of those deck plate ideas. On your presentation site some of the things you guys were looking at, the eDevo kind of thing. Can you talk about some of the ideas that were put forward and what the responses were to some of those ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. So today was the innovation competition part of the event. And I'm going to back up just a little bit to kind of explain what happened on Friday and Saturday. That kind of gives context for what actually occurred this morning. But in the mornings on both Friday and Saturday, we had the emerging leader plenary sessions, and this was giving an opportunity to young junior officers and others in the national security space a chance to talk about things and ideas that's been on their minds. There's really no other setting in DOD or national security where young people, especially in uniform, can, I don't want to use the word pontificate, but talk about some of the big things that they've been thinking about strategically or otherwise. So we had everybody from a Quaker pacifist who's an entrepreneur in her off time talk about her philosophy and how nonviolence has, you know, affected national security throughout the world, to Chris Zember, who's running the IACS throughout the Department of Defense and trying to bring in new technologies to the DoD. One of my best friends, Brian Ferguson, who is actually co-founder of Disruptive Thinkers with me, gave a stunning talk yesterday about how, you know, DoD needs to think about the way that we organize to face dynamic and complex threats. And then that was juxtaposed with Josh Marcuse from OSG Policy, who is really trying to push design thinking, which is a methodology kind of pioneered out in Silicon Valley by Stanford and a group called IDEO, in how we approach problems. And so from that theoretical foundational discussion, we went into the afternoon case study sessions, or recruited a cadre of senior officers, both in uniform and those who have retired, to talk about leadership challenges that they've faced throughout their career to attempt to impart wisdom to this emerging generation. So a couple that come to mind that were really pretty influential. One of my mentors, Captain Dan Groper Moore, who retired from the service a couple of years ago, talked about a situation he faced in 1995 when he was a commanding officer of an F-18 squadron, where he submitted a report the second to last day of his tenure in the squadron in accordance with Navy regulations, talking about some readiness challenges his squadron was facing. And his reporting senior came to him and basically gave him had two fit reps. He said, if you rescind this report, I'll give you the good fit rep. If you don't rescind this report, I'll give you the bad fit rep. And so his case study was, well, what do you do in that situation? So we spent 40 minutes talking through all the particular permutations, and then Captain Moore revealed what he did and what the aftermath of his decision was. And so we really wanted to give, you know, a lot of these emerging leaders who may face similar moral, physical, or moral and other challenges, professional challenges, an opportunity to face, to deal with these right now and kind of work through some of these challenges. We also had a presentation from Colonel Michael Bob Starr, who's a wing commander down at Dyess Air Force Base. And, you know, we're the tech generation, all that. We were blown away with the things that he's using to engage his airmen down in Texas. For instance, there's a presentation, online presentation tool, where whenever he has a commander's call, he will walk into the audience of 600 or 700 airmen, specifically direct them to take their phones out, go to a website, and has an interactive presentation where he'll ask them poll questions. In real time, the numbers will be calculated, put on the screen, the airman can ask questions over this app, and he controls everything from his iPhone. And so really innovative ways to reach, you know, a younger generation and kind of speak on their level. So kind of imparting these little tidbits of wisdom. And then yesterday we had a very unique two-hour session, which we called the UnConference, where anybody who attended the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum could sign up for a 15-minute kind of rotational thing to talk about an idea they had or something like that. And every 15 minutes we'd rotate to something else. We were able to get 18 new individuals to talk about everything from their idea, their concept of how change is made, to, you know, how do we get military approach to go to college more often? How do we look at our retirement system? How can we, you know, create an outpost in Silicon Valley? And this really, you know, intellectually diverse group of individuals interacted throughout the weekend. And again, it culminated this morning in the innovation competition, which was sponsored by the Naval Institute. So much as they do the essay contest throughout the year, you know, they wanted to help us out and do an innovation competition. So we recruited a board of five senior judges. One was Deputy Assistant Secretary John Johns, who's done a lot with maintenance. The Tesla CIO, Jay Vigian, was there to judge. We had Colonel Starr on the panel, Fred Rainbow from USNI, and one of the professors from Booth there. And the eight great presentations. The first one was done by Lieutenant Josh Steinman, who has put forth a proposal to create a permanent DoD presence in Silicon Valley. The second one was done by a guy named Ben Bynes, who was a former F-18 pilot, now at Harvard Business School, but pitching a new financial management tool for service members transitioning. You know, we have TSP and all that stuff, but his idea is, well, we should have wealth management options to prepare those people transitioning to other opportunities. We had another one that talked about the eDivo app, which you mentioned, created by Charlie Hyman. Basically, on an iPhone application, you can have every single publication ever created by the Navy at your fingertips. You can reference it real time. It's broken up by, you know, intuitive subject matter, and a guy on the bridge can pull up anything whenever he wants, as long as he's synced to a database. Another guy created this app called Blue Force Tracker, which is a journalism app that really kind of pulls from veteran reporters and photojournalists to get ideas back into the hands of civilians and kind of bridge that civil-military divide. Blair, who is an Air Force officer, has this idea called Money Jet, which, if you're familiar with the Moneyball book and the movie you guys have all seen, using analytical data to basically track every single thing a pilot is doing. So, for instance, as an F-18 guy, Very rarely were we tracking, you know, how accurate my missile shots were or how, you know, where I was in the deck and, you know, all these flight parameters. That we have so much rich data. There's got to be a way we can harness that and analytically apply it to follow a guy through his career so we can see improvement, use it for training and safety data. And the one that stole the show, though, that won the competition at the end was a project created by Major Mark Jacobson, who's an Air Force C-17 pilot, now getting a PhD at Stanford. But it's called the Syria Airlift Project. And his goal is to create very cheap drones that can drop humanitarian supplies into besieged areas. So, you know, with a 2 or 3 pound payload, they can deliver critical medical supplies. They can deliver, you know, vitamins and other foodstuffs to places like Aleppo, which may be under siege by ISIS terrorists or whatnot. And through that process, one of the things he had done at one point was work with his wife to bake granola into the wing form of the UAV that he was kind of creating. And while it didn't work, it just kind of showcases the tinkering mindset that some of our folks are going through to come up with very unique solutions to very specific national security problems.
And Ben, your connection's a little broken up, so if you've moved since the beginning of this show, maybe go back to where you were before, but we got you 4x4, so it's working just fine.
Okay. Got that. Apologies.
One thing about the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, it's still pretty young, and many times when you start a project and it's collaborative, but because you're there from the birth, it's kind of your baby. And when you first have your baby, there are some great ideas of directions you think it'll go in that'll work real well, but when you actually start to do it, it doesn't quite get the grip it wants to. But other avenues open up that you can take advantage of, and many times your baby can start developing in ways you really didn't expect at all. You know, looking back at where you came this weekend, what are some of those things that you thought you were going to head in a certain direction, but what were those opportunities that you opened up that maybe you didn't appreciate the opportunity that was there?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest evolutions between the first and second year was we wanted to get that hackathon mentality that first year. So we devoted 4 hours on the first 2 days of the initial conference to kind of emergent breakout sessions where groups would form, you know, do 8 hours of good work and then present their idea at the pitch competition. And we found that just did not work at all. I mean, people certainly enjoyed the engagement and kind of exploring different options and ideas, but the quality of the pitches was not that good. The engagement just wasn't there. So we, again, decided to put in those senior leader-led case studies instead of that. And then for the innovation competition, really let guys work for 6 to 8 months on their project so that they'd have a tangible end state and a really good thing that they could present to the crowd. Another one that comes to mind is, you know, as we left the conference last year, there was a lot of excitement, a lot of motivation to do other things. And, you know, we wanted to create these regional DEFX events that would kind of capture the cognitive surplus of different regional areas. And we had a couple last year. You know, we had the one in Annapolis run by Midshipman Mike Madrid and then one down in Norfolk. The first one got about 100 folks and the second one only about 20 people. So that's something we're still kind of trying to figure out is, you know, how do you capture all this energy and, you know, all this excitement that comes from this movement and then take it to another level in different areas? Because everybody leaves here super excited. They go to their day job, they go back to their, you know, normal day-to-day operation, and they kind of lose the motivation. So how can we capture that lightning and continue to perpetuate it throughout the DOD and throughout the duty stations? So the thing I unveiled this year was called Def Agora. So as you guys probably know it, the Agora in the Greek ecosystem was the center of town where people would come to discuss ideas and have deep thoughts. What we want to do, small agoras throughout the country, could be anything from a dinner party to a book discussion, but to kind of broaden your network beyond your, you know, either the maritime service friends you have or the military friends, and tap into the civilian networks that might impart some wisdom to you. And, you know, with these disparate networks across the country, if you're on TAD or moving somewhere, you can tap into a ready network of innovators that will be ready to, one, embrace you, but also give you a tie into how you can be creative in your new command. So we'll see how that goes. We're going to launch that and see if it works. But we're always trying to iterate, experiment, and try new things.
Who attends this event, and how many people did you have this time as compared to last year?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll answer the number question first. Last year we had 115 registrants, and about 95 people showed up throughout the weekend. This year we had 150 registrants, and that was actually sold out. So we've capped the number at 150 based on the research of a guy named Dunbar. So Dunbar's number basically states that you really can have no more than 150 close relationships at one time, otherwise it becomes unwieldy. And we wanted to create an intimate setting where people would be relationally engaged and want to interact with each other. So we had about 4 to 5 people on the waiting list this year, and about 135 to 140 folks showed up for all the days, more at the happy hours than not, because, you know, drinking and food always kind of stokes the creative energies. But the people who were there ranged everywhere from a congressional staffer for Senator Kaine, who gave a plenary session, to members of OSD policy, to, you know, every uniformed service was represented with junior officers. A couple senior officers attended 0506 level. General Michelle from the Air Force was there doing a case study. Colonel Pete Newell, who used to run the Army's Rapid Equipping Force, gave a case study. Admiral Bill Gortney was there. I did an interview with him for an hour. Lieutenant General Bob Brown came by. Also, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Garcia stopped by kind of as a lurker just to kind of see what the network was, and he left incredibly impressed. So hopefully we'll see him there again next year hosting his own session. But it really was a way for the junior folks to interact directly with senior policymakers, with the junior folks having the center stage, their ideas front and center, and building these really strong relational networks that really cross traditional parochial service stovepipes.
One of the things that caught my attention early on in the show that I thought I'd turn into a question for you is, and thinking of buy-in, I was a bad host. I didn't mention in the opening of the show, for those that are with us live, if you're interested, you have some concepts or some ideas that you want to share with us during the course of the show, scroll to the bottom of the show page. That's where the chat room is. If you wanted to put something that I've got to address with our guest, that's a great way to do it. And so bottom of the page, there's a chat, the chat room for you. Getting back to my question for you, Ben, is when you look at a lot of the topics, you know, we're looking at ideas, projects, concepts, maybe even a change of way that we can do things, looking for efficiencies, looking for basically to make the fleet a better place than it is. But in this line of work, there's one item that supports everything else. It girds everything else. It's woven into everything we do. And without it, everything else is just worthless. And you brought up the topic when you briefly mentioned the talk that y'all had about the pay-for-play fit rep, that anybody that's been in the service for some length of time have at least a half dozen stories very similar to that. But that addressed the topic of leadership. Without leadership and the right leadership, you can have all the great ideas, projects, concepts, and new technology you want to, but you're not going to be able to do anything with them because the people who have those ideas, if they aren't supported, they're going to take their drive and their intelligence elsewhere. And how do you see, were there additional discussions on how leadership and the right type of leadership can be a catalyst, vice a barrier to transparency and innovation, which in any successful organization you do really need to have, and that includes the armed services?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think woven through every single talk was the importance of people over technology, and that people question comes down to leadership and those that are advocating for solutions. You know, when we talk about innovation, I think far too often people automatically assume we're talking about technology and a new widget that's going to change things. But at the end of the day, it comes down to people, and it comes down to mentorship. It comes down to the right leaders advocating for the right courses of action and empowering the right people to make changes. So we actually had a breakout session, or we call it Death Stories, at the beginning of yesterday, where we gave 5 people 5 minutes to do a vignette on a leader, a mentor, or a friend in their life that had a significant impact on who they were today. And we heard stories, you know, of a Vietnam Marine Corps mentor who went in and saved one of his Marines and was berated by a company commander. And it was, at the end of the day, exonerated by a general who told him that what he had done was correct. But that set the example for his troops that, hey, our people are the number one priority. We will go in and protect them. And, you know, my own experience on the CNO Rapid Innovation Cell is that the 07 level leadership of that organization is absolutely critical to getting the ideas forward. We've had multiple commanders and There have been a couple good ones and a couple not so good ones, and the difference is stark. When you have a guy who's an advocate and a pit bull and wants to make stuff happen, it's amazing how quickly junior officer ideas can come to the fore and get the attention of 3 and 4 stars. But when you have a leader who is kind of reticent to engage beyond his pay grade, the envelope, and very process-oriented, a little bit scared almost to push the envelope, then all those ideas just kind of wither on the vine. So leadership is absolutely critical. And one of the things we want to do in future years and try to do this year was just have senior leaders come and see this network in action. There was a lot of skepticism last year when we first pushed this. You know, are these a bunch of disgruntled junior officers who are trying to buck the system and, you know, create change and disruption just for the sake of, you know, giving the finger to the system? Well, as the senior leaders who have come have seen, this is an incredibly dynamic, action-oriented, and focused organization that wants to make a difference for national security. We want to solve the problems. We want to work hand-in-hand to come up with good solutions. And those senior leaders who have come have walked away incredibly impressed. You know, Lieutenant General Brown came yesterday, and he was skeptical on the car ride down from O'Hare, but as he was leaving, I heard from his aide that he was just over the moon at the network he had discovered. And I think when people experience this weekend firsthand, they realize that there is something magical going on. There's something relational going on. We're deeply embedded in each other's lives, and those close-linked relationships really lead to enduring change.
Well, I got a couple of questions for you. I know you guys had a live stream for much of the conference, and
yep.
Or forum, if you will. Is there going to be a YouTube place where people can go see what you guys were up to?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. We certainly plan to do that. We've worked with Booth, the School of Business, and they are creating some HD versions of all the plenary talks. Some of the speakers are a bit reticent to put them out in the public right now, but we will release as much as we can when we can, and certainly would love to distribute them to your listeners, because they're great talks. I mean, they go into some really deep issues and a very unique perspective on the world. So, yeah, they'll be available.
Well, great. Keep us posted on that. And then the second question I have has to do with if I've got a brilliant idea, which is doubtful, but let's suppose I had a really great idea and I thought,
yeah.
You know, I want to present this to some folks. How do I do this? How do I get involved in becoming part of the Defense Entrepreneurial Forum, Entrepreneur Forum?
Yeah. I mean, you could always just email me and I'm happy to tap you in. I'm more of a facilitator, not necessarily a technology guy. But if you're in the Navy, I would highly recommend you join the CNO Rapid Innovation Cell X group. It's basically open to anybody of any rank who has an idea. We have, you know, very robust discussions over a Gmail listserv, as well as on Facebook and elsewhere. And we've created an ecosystem that any sailor anywhere can tap into, and we can get them the right resources to at least see if their idea is viable. And, you know, 9 out of 10 ideas won't be viable. Part of the process is just experimenting and prototyping and meeting the right people who can introduce you to the next right person. What the CRIC has been really good at doing is developing relationships across different parts of the Navy that weren't previously linked, in addition to industry partners, you know, in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. We have a knack for being able to sell and cold call people and aren't really afraid of being told no. And because of that, we can connect the right people who have ideas to the people who actually make it happen. And really, it's linking up that junior innovation, that cognitive surplus at the very bottom, with those senior decision makers who are willing to push the bounds just a little bit to give a guy a chance. So, yeah, CRICX is a great job for the Navy, but you go on our defenseentrepreneurs.org website, and we have contact links. You can email any one of us. We'll be happy to link you into our communities within DOD and elsewhere.
Great. Thanks.
Absolutely.
Hey, Ben. Yeah, I was off for
yeah.
a little bit getting our other guest on. We got you for about 5 more minutes, and you've kind of touched on it as well, and it kind of ties into my previous question. I talked to a few of the folks that were there last year afterwards, and I'll probably talk to the same people again this year. But you and I both know that there are, and I won't embarrass them by mentioning their name, and likewise those that, or on the other side of the spectrum, I won't put them on report either. But we have some general officers and flag officers that get it. They really do.
Yep.
They're very engaging, whether it's in a a networking situation, or you know, you get stuck in a car with them for a while, and they'll communicate with you via official, unofficial paths. They're really looking for ideas, and there's always a joy when you see one of them in the room. There are some other ones though that just don't seem to get it. If they go to something like a deaf conference, it's just another trip they're going on. The speech they give in San Diego to a bunch of recruits is almost the same as the speech as they give to a group of 06s. Of the senior officers, and I think you could put Juan Garcia in this group too from the civilian side of the house, the senior leadership that you're seeing to show up, are you seeing a high percentage of those that really get it? And if you've gotten some from the other side of the equation who didn't quite get it, how many deer in the headlights did you get from people who really expected something else but kind of got caught up in something different once they showed up?
Yeah. The people who come to DEF are very self-selecting, and I'd say 95% of them pay their own way and take leave to go there. There are very few people who go on official orders, and so that's a self-weeding garden, if you will. There are certainly those senior leaders who are very comfortable with the system, and they've grown up in the system, they've been promoted within the system, and it works for them, and that's fine. I mean, that works for them. And we just kind of ignore them as we're, you know, doing our things. We will tap into their networks if they find interest in something, but we're not really willing to be told no. And, you know, we do it respectfully. If we really believe in something, take Google Glass, for instance, you know, when we try to integrate that into the fleet, there was a lot of skepticism. People didn't understand what it was. But all you have to do is find one or two touch points. You could have 110 naysayers, and all you need is that one person to say yes. If you're willing to go through those 110 people to say no to find that one person to say yes, you're going to be successful eventually if what you are actually selling is of value. And so it really takes endurance and perseverance and, you know, that term grit that we all throw about. To do this innovation stuff. But we kind of just bypass the ones that don't believe in us just because we know that there's somebody eventually going to come to our aid and help us out. And then, you know, 2-3 years down the road, that person who said no is probably out of that billet. Somebody new may have an opportunity to look at the role a little bit differently or to engage them when they do get there. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Yeah, I was just wondering whether you had any success in getting a convert, because occasionally you will get somebody, once they poke their head out of their shell, you can grab them by the ears and pull them out. And that's always a great thing to see, because then you turn a neutral into at least a possible ally, or at least somebody else who I think you mentioned, you can tap into their network. And if they're not the solution guy, maybe their chief of staff is, and it's nice to be able to let the tentacle spread in that respect.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't think of any true convert stories at the top of my head, but you know, part of it is just the more that you can talk about a certain topic, that's going to slowly seep into somebody's psyche. And it may not be like a Paul on the Road to Damascus type conversion, but over a course of a couple months or interacting with more and more folks, they may have a change of thought, change of heart that you don't even notice until one day they make a decision that blows your mind because finally this person gets it. So.
Well, speaking of that sort of thing, what's up next for you, and where are you guys headed with this as we wrap up your short visit with us today?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and that's something that we will have to think hard about in the coming months. We've gotten some opportunities from some other foundations interested in doing policy innovation, so we're probably going to do a policy DefEx in D.C. here early this spring. There's a lot of excitement to do more regional events this year. One of the things we're banding about is doing a DefEx Pentagon and kind of going straight to the heart of the challenges that we face and kind of showcase what we're doing and the value we bring as opposed to the potential challenges we bring. And then the DEF Agoras, really building out this loose-tied network of individuals who are relationally focused. You know, it doesn't have to be a day-long, 12-hour event, but just a dinner party to talk about Thucydides over a couple scotches or something, that can go a long way to developing relationships. And what I found is that you don't know what a relationship is going to build until that aha moment when you're talking or at a bar or have this epiphany moment, and you can finally link up with someone that, you know, you may not have thought you had a connection with, but there's an intersection that occurs and magic happens. So we really want to be at the center of serendipity and kind of perpetuate this throughout the country in different little cells. So we'll see if that model works, but we think it has a pretty good chance of doing so.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ben, you and the rest of your band of merry men and women, getting the conversation going, getting the creative friction of a lot of people whose heart and minds are in the right place, getting to talk about a subject, really nothing but good can come from it. So I've really enjoyed watching what y'all have been doing and talking to a few of you. Congratulations, and get back to work, I guess, is what your boss would say.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for the opportunity. We'll talk to you soon.
Oh, yeah. Keep us posted on what's happening, Ben. We'd like to know how this goes forward.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Take care, Ben. Hey, now let's go ahead and shift over to our second guest today for the next hour. We're going to bring on board U.S. Marine Corps Major Carl Forslund. He's going to be on to really start unpacking his article, Unpacking the Veterans Entitlement Spectrum. A little bit of Carl's background. He's a Marine MV-22 pilot. He's also been in the 46th. So I don't know if BJ is with us, so there's another 46 brother for you. He's deployed with and also has been an instructor in both platforms. He also has served as a military advisor to the Afghan Border Police Battalion. He is currently the executive officer at Marine Medium Tilt Rotor Training Squadron 204, training Osprey pilots for both the Marine Corps and the Air Force. He got his bachelor's degrees from Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and his master's from Boston University. His writing has appeared both in the Marine Corps Gazette, Naval Institute Proceedings, Small Wars Journal, Approach, and others. And he liked to hang out on Twitter, so go bother him if you want to at Carl Forslund. Carl, welcome to MIDRATS. Great to have you aboard.
Evening. Glad to be here.
I found, and just so you know, you are a special snowflake. I'll let everybody know we adjusted our schedule for you, so don't feel like you have to be nice to us or anything. But
I appreciate
one thing that I found. One thing I found very interesting about your article, especially your own active duty. You're the XO of a training squadron. You're not somebody who's off in the shadows, but you're not. You don't have anybody who's read your writing knows you're a person that's very competent in your opinions and your ideas. But what I found very interesting about your article, and people that are on the show page can find it linked. The title is Unpacking the Veterans Entitlement Spectrum. Is that back when you deal with veterans issues, especially something that goes beyond hagiographic and praise, but really touching on some serious issues, it can be a minefield, it can be touchy, you're more likely to run into people who react with emotion, vice thinking through your issues. What drove you to take a deep breath and say, this issue is important to me, I'm going to address it, and I'm going to address it in the manner in which I did?
Well, I think it's the entitlement article, and there's another article I wrote earlier about thanking veterans, and both of them got some very positive but a lot of very impassioned negative response. And the reason I took that on, I see, a big, that it's a big product of that gap between the military and civilian world, and I think it's probably growing every day. And the entitlement part touches on that part that I think is self-inflicted. And, there's a lot of, obviously, on the civilian side, as the number of veterans in the population decreases as a percentage, obviously fewer civilians have contact with veterans. And, seeing that, that minimal amount of contact often becomes negative because of a presumption of superiority on the part of veterans sometimes, that the gap is so big that they believe civilians can't possibly understand what they've been through. And I think that's where a lot of the emotion on the other side comes from. But, so veterans have borne a huge load over the last 13 years now. And, they have the right to be proud of their service and the right to be derive a lot of personal satisfaction from that because it's incredibly important work. But when you're talking to civilians who don't have that background and come through it from an angle of, a veteran is better than a civilian because he's done these things, that's a veteran you know, believes that, you know, a civilian can't possibly comprehend it and comes from a position of entitlement. We're not talking about the, you know, your pay and your benefits and your VA and all that stuff that is entitled to you by law, by tradition, et cetera. We're talking about a mentality. And you see this, you know, in casual interactions. You know, the Marine who pulls his military ID out at the traffic stop, or, you know, the soldier or Marine who gets kicked out of a bar and pulls the veteran's card saying, you can't treat me like this, I'm a veteran. That sort of interaction colors a more than significant percentage of how civilians see the military. And we complain about the gap, but we are contributing to it in a lot of ways by coming at it from, you know, a superior point of view, or at least the appearance of that. So, you know, just like anything else, when you're trying to teach somebody about your experience, teach them. If you come out from a position of, you know, I am throwing down the troops from the mountain to a civilian, they're not going to respond to that. A belief that you're entitled to something. You know, the biggest, you know, an example would be the, you know, a lot of establishments, Home Depot, Lowe's, have various veterans discounts. You know, some of them are all full-time, some of them are part-time. You'll see, I mean, just going through a military town, you'll see a lot of times when someone will their ID does not meet the criteria, or they're on the wrong day, and we'll pull, hey, I was in Afghanistan, I was in Iraq. Well, that's great. But that clerk is just doing his job, you know, just like you were just doing your job. And a little bit of empathy for that person's position goes a long way. You know, it's productive to interact with civilians, get off the base, you know, via church, via clubs, via whatever it is, and interact with them and show them what the military is about. But coming from a position of lecturing them, it's not going to be very responsive. It's not going to help veterans in the long run. That's really what I came at with that article in particular.
Yeah, your article is pretty interesting because I really, living in a town that has very few active duty people in it, I don't see, that card being played that much, although I can see where you're coming from. On the other hand, as I was reading, I said, you know, this is kind of the opposite position of someone who sees every veteran as being a poor, disabled, mentally defective human being who is
right.
One day away from being homeless and drug addicted. So, I guess there's some, you know, the civilian world doesn't seem to know a whole lot about veterans, and certainly doesn't know a whole lot about the current active duty force, because it's all voluntary. And unless we talk about it and present it in a more positive light, they're not going to know. I mean, is that kind of where you're going with this thought process of yours?
Exactly. It's trying to, you know, the best way to teach somebody, just like, you know, trying to teach your kids, you know, not to swear, how to be polite. Yes, there is a certain way of correction in a kid, but really the most long-lasting way to show anything is to be that example. So if you want to show civilians that veterans are, you know, well-trained, well-skilled, productive members of society, the best example is to just be that and let the action speak for it. You know, going on about how you learn this in Afghanistan or learn this in the military, that's great, and you can know that. But by being that professional, they know you're in the military. They know you were in the military. That's usually pretty self-evident. So bringing that card could be kind of counterproductive in my experience. Being that example and being that productive veteran is really the best way to show that we're going to be that positive influence and not the downtrodden, homeless, cripple, et cetera, that some of the other media would portray us as.
When you go on and mention that, I try to mention this book every opportunity I get for a couple of reasons. One, it predates 9/11, so there's no opportunity for one side or the other to say the book is tainted by the politics of post 9/11 national defense. Two, it's written for the right reason by a guy who really was a trailblazer, especially before internet made technology. That's B.G. Burkett's Stolen Valor that came out about what happened to the Vietnam generation. And, you know, my co-host, even though he sounds like a young, strapping man, and I guess he still is, Eagle One is a quasi-Vietnam era veteran.
All that time I spent bobbing around off the coast out there only made me quasi.
Well, you know, somebody had to bring the toilet paper over there. It was an honorable job. There's nothing to worry about. And you know, I'm still a kid, but you know, in Eagle One's in a better position to talk about how veterans were received in the mid to late 70s, while I was just outgrowing my big wheel. But when I was in NROTC in the 1980s, we were still under the shadow of how they were treated. I remember one of the first conversations that they had with us was, you know, hey, you wear your uniform on this day. It's okay if you take it off right after we get done, or you put it on right before. Be careful where you wear it. And I remember there was a big hubbub on campus because the faculty senate passed a resolution that made it. It took me a while to figure out what was going on. It was finally explained to me. Basically, they could no longer discriminate based upon Vietnam War era status, because they wanted to remove any type of veterans benefits. Because those that didn't go to Vietnam who were on the faculty didn't like the fact that they didn't have as many openings as those who did, so they eliminated that. And it's almost like a 100% opposite now where we were before, where you go through, every time I fly through airport, it's cringeworthy. I have one more person thank anybody who ever wore the uniform, and usually it's some boot that's walking around and is going between boot camp and his home Liberty who hasn't deployed or anything. And, of course, you have the people over at Wounded Warrior Project whose commercials are, you can't separate them from the Save a Puppy at a Pound commercials. I think they use the same soundtrack. And I'm wondering how much of this isn't driven, it isn't a pull by those who have served wanting this special attention, though that is there, and I've seen it as you have, Carl, as well, the people who make a scene at Lowe's. But how much of it is coming from the civilian side, those who haven't served, that either are trying to compensate for what they did when their peers came back from Vietnam, or those that are somehow working through their own guilt of not serving by overcompensating towards those who did? I don't know, and none of us are trained psychiatrists, but how much do you see of that actually being pushed from the civilian side by veterans holding their breath till they turn purple, demanding something?
I think that's huge. I think both those things sort of feed on each other. You know, that because some civilians overcompensate, veterans think that's a 100% thing sometimes. It happens 24/7. But I think you're right. On the civilian side, because, you know, like it or not, we're a volunteer force. And even if everyone wanted to join, they could not. I mean, that's just a fact of numbers. So only a small, very small percentage of our population is ever going to have served in the military the way it's structured today, and rightfully so. But especially when you're dealing with a war that's going on, you know, one form or another for over 13 years now, you know, they see the small percentage paying, you know, pretty much 100% of the price. You know, we haven't even asked, you know, at least in World War II, you know, you're rationing aluminum, you were doing drives to, you know, my grandmother would talk about, you know, collecting her grease and driving it to the recycling plant so they could make nitroglycerin. So everyone had a stake in the conflict, everyone made sacrifices for it, and they could feel as if they were contributing to it. So the civilian side sees that, you know, this small group, and that they feel, you know, indebted, and they're searching for a way to somehow pay off that debt. And usually it's something, you know, the let's thank our troops. So that's on a personal level, being stopped at a store and saying, you know, thank you, son, for your service. Or, you know, every sporting event I've been to for the last several years has, you know, would all our veterans please stand up? You know, that's all part of that same thing. You know, and there is that gap. And we as a society haven't done anything to try and close that, to try and give people a, you know, avenue to serve something larger themselves other than the military. So there's this 1% that does serve, the 99% that doesn't, and they have to somehow psychologically justify, you know, to themselves and others that, you know, they've done something, and that's usually just, you know, thanking the military in some fashion. And I think that's a big problem society-wide. And I think we've failed to, I'm not sure whether we need to go back some sort of mandatory, service project like some people propose. But the fact that there's really no avenue for people to express that need to serve something bigger means that that 1% that does, makes them a privileged few, if you will. And I think that's that feeds both ends, both the civilian side feeling like they have a debt to pay and the military feeling like they rate collecting that debt from every citizen, at least in some extreme examples. I'm not going to say that the military entitlement piece is everybody. By all means, it's not. But there is a percentage who thinks that way, and there's a percentage of the civilian world that feels they have to, pay this debt in some sort of psychic fashion, if you will.
Yeah, I mentioned this topic to my wife, and I asked her about specifically about the Home Depot and Lowe's discounts, which my older son, who's serving on active duty, told me about, because I didn't know about it before. But and she said, that's just good marketing on their part. They're going to get loyalty from people who are used to work, doing that kind of work. And she didn't have a problem with that. But, I think your point is completely different. It's, if somebody offers you a discount, then that's perfectly okay. If they feel that it helps them in some way, that's great. But it's you're more concerned about the people who, like the person who identifies themselves as the colonel's spouse and demands a privilege that way. You're more concerned about the people who say, I'm a veteran, therefore I'm entitled to this, as opposed to accepting what somebody's willing to give you as a marketing tool or just as a way of saying thank you.
Right.
Or am I off base on that?
You're completely right. The spouse thing is a whole other friction point for a lot of people in and out of the military. From a lot of angles, whether it's the assuming the privileges of the service member, whether that's the service in general, or obviously the spouses who think they have the rank of the active duty member. That's a whole other phenomenon that probably has it could rate its own show in and of itself. Yes, the idea that, they don't have to give this discount in the first place. They don't have to give you a special privilege. And you'll see, while I was researching the article on this, there are complete internet hate pages for Sears, for example. They offered a free gift card, I think it was $20 for veterans, and that their system got backlogged, and which is, that happens to the internet sometimes. And the hate, basically saying that Sears doesn't value veterans, et cetera, like that is just completely irrational. They're trying to do a good thing, and granted, their IT might not have been the best, but they never had to do this in the first place. And then you're complaining because it takes a little bit longer to sign up for it. That's kind of a symptom of what I'm talking about.
I wanted to, and again, none of us are trained psychiatrists, but it's something that I think we've all seen. And I wonder if the sense of entitlement we have, whether it's a symptom of a larger issue, and here's what I'm thinking about, is when you talk about entitled, somebody who is entitled or isn't satisfied with something, it's because they are very self-focused. They're very focused on themselves and their wants and their desires, whether to have more money, have more attention, to feel more special, or to compensate for something else, a type of narcissism. And when you look at some of the things that we do in the service and have changed since our forefathers, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, those guys were, especially the Korean War veterans who were peers of my father that I knew well, very humble individuals. Some of the people, I found out what their background was. I wish I knew 10 years before they passed so I could have talked to them about it some. But the way we do things nowadays, especially in the Navy, rumor has it the Marine Corps hasn't gone this bad. But if you look at how we write our fit reps, how especially even more than the Navy, the Air Force and the Army, you get a ribbon for not being kicked out of boot camp. You you get a ribbon for having a solid bowel movement, perhaps. I don't know. It seems that way. Every time we write an award, every time we write an eval, a fitness report, the hyperbole is off the charts. And very little, it seems, that what we do trains people to develop a certain bit of humility about the seriousness of their profession and the service part of being a service member, that you're not, you know, we are a nation that has a military. This isn't Prussia. We have a military that has a nation. Are there things that we are doing or not doing culturally, you think, that might be able to help mitigate some of this byproduct of narcissism and excessive sense of self-worth that some people do are developed based upon something that they actually just volunteered to do by freedom of choice anyway?
Yeah, I think those are, you know, that's probably a symptom vice a cause, maybe. Or maybe it's just, you know, we're carrying through into the military what they were raised on throughout their civilian lives. That, you know, we all know the stories of the soccer leagues. You don't keep score, and you know, everyone down through last place gets a ribbon and all that stuff. I think that pervades, you know, the entire society for better or for worse. And I think maybe that's just like a lot of things. Maybe it's a pendulum type of deal, that maybe we were a little too far the other direction, and now we've swung towards everyone's a special snowflake, and you think that's, that defines you, and everyone's going to, is above and beyond. It's, you know, everyone, the mean is average. You know, half of you are below average and half of you are above it. And we never quite fess up to that, and definitely your fit reps don't show that until you actually get down to the numbers and the numerical grades. I think probably as far as the civil military thing, I think it's kind of we've, again, because of the smaller numbers in the military has just become one more tribe in a larger society. And you don't see we have the number of military bases, you know, BRAC, for example, which I think is generally a good thing, you know, just to illustrate, you know, it used to be that almost every state in the union had a major military base in it. And so you would see these people out and about on a relatively regular basis. Now, you know, most of the military is, you know, predominantly in the South. Then you have the West Coast and some smattering in between. So the amount of interaction that the civilian has with the military, and definitely the military has a civilian, you know, in a military town like Jacksonville, North Carolina, if you wanted to, you could do your entire enlistment without ever interacting with a civilian if you really chose to. You know, that wouldn't have happened ages ago. And I think that's a lack of socializing in and out of the military, and even within the military, is a lot less than it may have been in the past. So you sort of, you know, in combination with that, hey, I'm a special snowflake, and all these people around me, you know, must be special snowflakes too. And we're entitled to, you know, more than we otherwise would be, because we're, so, you know, we're over and above the rest of the military and society.
Yeah, speaking as one of the best of the best of the best, according to my fit reps, you know, one of the things that bothered me when I got back from Desert Storm, as compared to when I got back from the Vietnam shores, everybody said you're a hero. I mean, I knew what my job was. My job did not involve, trust me, anything heroic. But all of a sudden, you know, everybody's telling me I'm a hero. And I just, and I don't know if this is going on with people involved in Iraq and Afghanistan and all that, but I mean, it seems to me that kind of, and I have a friend who was a Navy air controlman. He says, you know, when everybody's a hero, there is no special snowflake, if you will, real special snowflake. Is there a way to get people to back off on that, you think, and treat people as professionals? You know, that not every one of us who served did anything especially heroic, but we did do our jobs, and that's good enough. How do we deal with that with the people outside the service?
I think that's huge. I mean, I am definitely not a hero. I've done my job to the best of my ability and done some what I think are pretty good things. I'm not a hero. Dakota Meyer's a hero. You know, Kevin Carpenter's a hero. Guys like that are heroes. I'm not. And You know, how do you make people appreciate that, hey, a good day's work to an honest profession is enough for personal satisfaction? You know, I think, again, that probably speaks a lot bigger societal type issues. I mean, you know, everyone wants to be a reality TV star. You know, the idea that you go to a factory for 30 years and you make cars or whatever, and that's a good, honest work, that you've done something worthwhile. You know, everyone wants to be a celebrity. Everyone wants to be the best. And to some extent, that's great. You know, you should achieve great things in your life. Try and, you know, set targets for yourself. But the idea that, you know, you have to be, you know, raised above the rest of the crowd to make your effort worthwhile, I think that's a bigger pathology. As far as how we fix it in the military, you know, I think, one, we're sort of our own worst enemies in a lot of ways. You know, the military itself doesn't really push those people who do truly go above and beyond to those heroic tasks. They don't publicize them very well. And they, at the same time, you know, pump this groupthink where, again, they pump the everyone is a special thing, and people believe that Kool-Aid. And I think we obviously indoctrinate people in the military, and I think that's one of the things that we could indoctrinate them in as well. You know, in the course of our training, in the course of how we, for example, write fit reps, you know, we can encourage people to tone down that language as a cultural thing. We can get rid of the idea of an end of tour award for everybody, for example. That'd be a concrete thing we could do here. The idea that, you know, there should not be any end of tour awards, period. Get rid of the system. The only way you get it is an impact award for a specific thing. That would go a long way towards, you know, accentuating those true heroes and those true people, you know, not even heroes, people who do, you know, actually special jobs that did a specific thing that was above and beyond their peers, you know, and not make that say, the fact that you didn't get one is not a black mark against you. God knows, if you leave a station, there's no end of tour awards. Gee, what did you do wrong? That should not be the mentality. The mentality, that should be reflecting as fit rep. The guy who got the medal should be that one rock star. And we need to go back to that as that'd be one concrete thing we could do.
Yeah, we lost the bubble on that a long time ago. I think probably draw the line. I think it was maybe 92, 93 in the Navy. It used to be that depending on the size of your command, you only had a certain quota of Navy Achievement Medals and Navy Comms you could, and then they slipped that so everybody could. If you didn't go to corrective custody, then you got your end of the tour award. You kind of lost the bubble on that. I agree. That adds to the atmosphere, and something else that adds to the atmosphere when we look at one thing that I liked about your article. Hopefully it will cause people to look at themselves and look at whether they really are entitled, whether they really are a special class. Are they really doing it too much? You know, do they have the entire tailgate of their pickup truck filled with bumper stickers that tell everybody that, you know, they served and did something somewhere? But where it really can get insidious, in my opinion, and you know, using the E word, the entitlement word, when you decide you want to leave active duty and you go through TAP class, whether normal or executive, I went through both, it really starts to develop a theme, and you can see it some in announcements from the VA and also from DOD and the executive branch and Congress too. It is almost turning veterans and people who have served in the military, retired or not, into an entitlement class, where you have you feel that you are entitled to have money from the public fisc, and you are entitled to your COLA, you're entitled to additional benefits. Especially when you go through the VA process, when you find out what people are getting disability for. You give birth twice and you have hemorrhoids, congratulations, you're a 10% disability. And that's just one example of many. That's true, by the way. And building that entitlement class, Then you go into the civilian world. And I've been in the civilian world since I left active duty in 2009. And one thing I see on a regular basis, people go, oh, you're retired military. You have this great retirement plan. You have this great health care plan that I never had an opportunity to get. I'll never get, regardless of how hard I work. And, oh, by the way, my net worth since 2008 has been cut by 50% because of the economy and the fact that my wife left me. You never have to worry about that, do you? And, of course, you don't want to talk about what can happen if you get divorced to your retirement pay. But we really do have, I don't know whether you could call it a golden parachute or a golden hammock, but we really do have a benefit system that is very, very attractive compared to the civilian world. I think some people are still stuck in the old argument of the old military-civilian wage gap that did once exist. But it's a very different economy now. How much danger, if we're not already there in many respects, I've seen it personally, that the resentment will grow towards those who have served in the military at a federal level, what we're starting to see in many cities towards their police and firemen who will let everything in the city not get funded except for their incredible pension packets. Are we potentially, by not addressing this problem internally, creating potential future problems to exacerbate that military-civilian gap?
I think that's huge. I think that's the really, if people want to know what the cost of having at least expressing an entitlement mentality of civilians is, you know, that's the cost. So if you keep this up, you know, at least some that percentage, whether it's 5 or 10% that do that, if we keep this attitude that we are entitled to more than what we were signed approved for when we signed up, I mean, I strongly believe that, hey, you did sign a contract and the retirement plan that existed when you signed, you are entitled to that. That being said, some of our advocacy organizations, you know, take a, I guess I'd say a take no prisoners or a slippery slope type of idea for it that, you know, if we give an inch, they'll take a mile, and before you know it, you know, the entire pension system will be gone or TRICARE will be gone, et cetera. And there is some validity to that, but the, you know, the idea of being completely unreasonable and presenting this idea that's we're entitled to more than the average civilian is will eventually cost us. People will say, well, this guy's being a jerk, basically, and I'm paying for his retirement, this one that's better than I'll get no matter how hard I work, as he said. Eventually, you know, if we don't address it by degrees now, it will come crashing down on us at some point, and we're going to get a lot less than what we would have if we'd, you know, taking a good hard look at ourselves and what the a retirement plan, for example, would do. You know, I'm of the mind that a retirement plan is bad for the military and the civilian world. I think it's, you know, again, feeds that entitlement mindset. You know, there's a lot of people in the military, you know, did their best contributions by 10 years. They're not, you know, for better or for worse, the way our system is structured, you know, if you're not, for an officer, if you're not going to be a commander, there's only so far you're going to go. But once you're past 10, you're going to try and find some job that keeps you there till 20. Whether or not that's what satisfies you or really what would do the best work for the military, that's that retirement system keeps you there. And you got to hold the retirement on that active duty phenomenon. So there's a lot of bad outcomes, you know, from a systemic standpoint and for the, you know, military work ethic within the military by the system we have right now. And eventually it's going to be fixed for us. And we can either have a hand in crafting something that works for us, or we can just see ourselves, okay, your 50% is now 40, you know, take it or leave it. If we take action and we work with it now, you know, maybe we could craft a plan that saves money and also helps the military out.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem. I've tried to figure out, as private enterprises have gone away from defined benefit plans with you know, retirement funding, where they had to put the money into an account someplace, and they have to account for it every year. I mean, the companies I work for, I was fortunate enough to be in a defined benefit plan, and they have some kind of annuity somewhere. It's all funded. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with the military is it's not funded. I mean, in theory, they were supposed to have funded it, but you know, like everything else, they didn't ever put the money aside. And if you try and calculate what it would take to have that money set aside every year, you know, that would change some of the problems we face down the road, I guess, that we would at least know what the expense were going to be. But it seems to me to be a really difficult problem having a defined benefit plan that is totally unfunded except by future revenues, and that makes it easy. Would make it easy for someone to come in and say, well, it's, you know, all this was based on the idea when you were a cavalryman in the out west and your lifespan after you got out of the service was about 10 minutes. And, you know, that situation's changed. But you went to the Wharton School. I assume you know more about economics than I do. But is there a path that forward that you could see that would make it fair to everybody, the civilians and the military, that wouldn't be an entitlement as much as this is a fairly obvious retirement plan, like any kind of plan you'd have with a private company?
I think, you know, you do have to sort of temper it and do a phase program, because obviously, you know, you do have those people who joined with a certain conception of what they were entitled to. But I think you could, obviously, just like we reformed it to a little bit back in the 80s, you know, after a certain date, that your plan is going to be subject to new rules. And one of the things I would recommend would be to eliminate the cliff system. You know, the cliff vesting is illegal in the civilian world. And, you know, with the exception of some, you know, incentive plans like the Marine Corps has Terra, where if you retire early because you're in an MOS they don't need or because you've been passed over, you get some prorated percentage of your 20-year retirement. We could walk that back and say, maybe you won't get that, you know, 50% of base pay at 20, but it phases in over time. So, again, you get the one thing we keep getting that I think is hugely detrimental is that our structure should be a pyramid, and it becomes sort of a pyramid at the bottom. In about 10 years of service, it becomes a cylinder. We need to have some sort of vesting allows you to get out before 20 and still retain some sort of retirement plan, and it gradually grows over time with service. Now, do I think it really needs to be a 401k? I don't think that's quite the right model for the military. I think there is some sort of, there's still some special nature of military service that rates a, maybe not defined benefits, but at least a, you know, some sort of guarantee of future income. But at the same time, the idea that 19 years and 364 days is zero and that 20 years is a great retirement, you know, all that does is keep people from 10 to 20 who don't want to be there, but they don't want to give that up. And the military is spending money on people who their last 5 to 10 years are much less productive than they otherwise could be. So I think it's bad from a money standpoint, it's bad from a morale standpoint, it's bad for a productivity standpoint. As there are plenty of people out there who do 15, they're like, well, I could get much better opportunities in the civilian world, I'm at still in my 30s, you know, peak of my skills is whatever I'm doing, but I'm not be a fool to leave at this point, but I'll find some job handing out basketballs at the gym for the last 5 years. You know, that's not doing anybody any good, but we foster that by our system.
I think the atmosphere right now is a lot more open to discussing the topic than it was before. There used to be, I think the last year they had it was 2011. They used to have a Milblog conference once a year up in D.C., and when I was up there in 2010, I asked one of the panels about the topic about looking towards some of the European models for their retirement system, very different than ours. One would argue from a governmental point of view, a lot more affordable for the government to do that. But nobody really wanted to step into that minefield. I thought the looks were rather humorous, but I think today you would get that panel to engage in the conversation a little more, simply because there are more people talking about it. You know, it's not just a major force wing out there, you know, discussing the topic. And like you mentioned early on in our conversation, you've received a lot of feedback, both pro and con. Who are some of the other people out there that are trying to address this in a productive way and looking for solutions, or at least trying to keep the conversation going, that if people wanted to dig in a little deeper into the topic, they should look up?
Well, I mean, there was just recently there was a pay and benefits commission that the military did. I believe it was 2 years ago. They took a fairly good look at this. And, again, they came up with something similar to what I described, where the immediate receipt of retirement does not happen at your 20-year anniversary. It's delayed sometime in the future. That would be hard-pressed to recall the exact name of it, but I'm sure you could find that. I think the budget cutters in the DOD have put out a lot of material saying that there are benefits on the money side, but I don't think people have addressed it from the personnel management side. And I think our veterans organizations, again, have just dug in their heels for the no change, no way, no how. So you see a lot of advocacy from, you know, military officers association, things like that, that are against change. I think they're just putting their fingers in the dike, and eventually they're going to see the dam collapse on top of them, and it's going to bring everyone with them if we just dig our heels and are not part of this. So, again, I think the Benefits Commission was a good starting point, but, again, I think there's another part that we're kind of missing out sometimes is the personnel management side is based on a early 20th century model. I think you sort of hit on it a little bit when you said it was based on the expectation that 20 years of military service, you were a used-up human being, and you're going to die pretty shortly after you got out. It's a much more technical field now for most jobs, and we look at this retirement thing in concert with personnel as a whole. We need to look at a lot more favorably on broken time. The idea that someone can leave the military, go into another field, bring knowledge back to the military at some later date, and not penalize that person for doing so. You can look at people transferring from services, one service to the other. The biggest example of this would be, say, computer technology. If we think we're getting the best computer experts in the military, we are sadly mistaken. And that's anybody who works with NMCI on their desk, Navy, Marine Corps, Internet would tell you that right away. But there's a lot of knowledge out there, but they're not going to work for military pay, or they're definitely not going to spend the whole career doing it. They might want to do a few years, get out. We might be able to get them into the reserves, or we might want to look at our pay system as a whole and allow special bonuses for types of things like that. And really look at a really good piece on this is Tim Keene, ex-Air Force officer, wrote a book called Bleeding Talent. I don't know if you've read that. Looks pretty much top to bottom at the military personnel system and how we're really messing it up in terms of just having this time and grade requirements, military wicket system. The way we manage personnel in terms of giving assignments is very similar to what you would have seen in, like, the Soviet Union for their entire economy. We defend capitalism, we defend democracy, but we pretty much work under a pseudo-socialist or communist model in terms of our labor does not have a price associated with it. And you got at that earlier when you were talking about funding retirement. We treat labor as if it's free, and that leads to all sorts of bad decisions. Labor's limited. We can only work our Marines and sailors so hard, but because we don't pay them by the hour, that cost is transparent. We make really bad personnel decisions because of it. And we put people in jobs that they're not trained for because he gets paid the same no matter what he does. We don't realize you're wasting money. If you don't look at it from a tactical standpoint, look at it from a money standpoint. We put guys on IAs, myself included. I spent a year, advising an Afghan border police unit. No private organization would ever entertain that idea. I mean, I think I did all right at the job, but it's definitely not my specialty. And it's probably not the best use of a Marine pilot's background, in all honesty. Things of that nature. So once you unlock the door on retirement, then you unlock the door on personnel management, the economics behind that. You see, we're kind of working in a very outdated system overall.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question about when you transition from the H-46 to the Osprey. Were there people who didn't make that transition who get burned because they happened to start out in the wrong aircraft, or is that a uniquely Navy phenomenon?
There were a few. I was one of the very first group that applied to get in right after the program opened up again, after the dark days, if you will. As the program went on, there were definitely some big issues, as far as this guy is too far along, you can't switch him over because he won't have time to get his department head tour and all that. So, and some people either passed the train, were anti-V-22s. That was obviously a very... big contingent in the Marine Corps for a long time because of all the bad experience of the V-22 in the 90s, you know, some people just never wanted to have anything to do with it, and they were hoping for it to fail. And then they passed up opportunities to get into it in the earlier days. And then by the time they were forced to, it was too far along, and you know, the Marine Corps said, yeah, it's not worth doing it this time. So there are definitely some guys out there who did that. But eventually, you know, there's no place left to hide. Although there still is people out there, I was sort of liking them to, you know, the Japanese soldier who was found on a Pacific island in 1965 who still thinks the war is going on. You know, there's some definite guys like that out in the 46 world who are holding out as long as they could, and then you realize the war is over and there's no more 46s left for them to go back to. But there's some people who got burned, and there's some people who got, you know, unfair benefits, and some people who got unfairly cast aside because they were at the wrong billet when they would have otherwise done that transition.
It kind of reminds me of go ahead, Eagle One.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Well, Eagle One broke the seal on the...
was just thinking that it reminds me that when you were talking about the inefficiency of our personnel system, you know, which leads to the whole benefit package and all that, is we don't necessarily do what a private company would do if it had good people that could be retrained to do something new and better. It's like we're more than happy, just as you said, there's no cost to the command to say, well, you know, this guy is just too far along and he'll never make it as a V-22 pilot. So we'll just let him go collect basketball at the gym as he finishes up his career.
We've all seen that huge waste of human capital. After I got my commission.
There?
Yeah, you're still there. I was sharing a beer with a Marine Corps major. Imagine that. I asked him what he did. He said he's waiting to be mummified and put on a static display because he was a backseater in F-4s. But he was waiting to get picked up for the then fresh and new Deltas. I think it was, Deltas.
F-18 Deltas.
Yeah. While we're talking about the Osprey here, and I think you're in a good position for it, and Chris over in the chat room wanted us to at least address some of it. And one thing I would like to ask for, because it kind of ties in some ways to our conversation with Ben and one of the regular topics we've had here on the show about being a learning institution. Long development time for the Osprey. It's with us, but it's also got some deployments under its belt in Afghanistan. What are some of those operational lessons that we've learned from Afghanistan that in the training squadron you're inculcating into the curriculum, or perhaps some airframe changes that we're looking at based upon that operational experience to make the Osprey an even better aircraft than it is?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, use the acquisition term, a spiral development process, sort of built into the mix from the get-go. So you saw initially the first Ospreys created were called Block A's. And right now the only ones left are in the training command. They have less fuel. Because they're first out, they don't have the reliability features that were sort of incorporated by learning what parts break sooner, and also just simple things like, gee, we have to work on this one component a lot. Let's make an extra panel here so we can go look at it better. And so the Block Bs have more gas in them. The Block Cs have weather radar, things like that. So that was built into the process to begin with. As far as lessons from Afghanistan, I think particularly Iraq as well is where it really cut its teeth. One of the things we emphasize now is, you know, use of automation. Especially in the reduced visibility landing environment, so what most people call brownouts. It brings to mind when I went to Afghanistan in 2001 in the 46, and you know, I had a reinforced squadron, so it was 46s, 53s, both types of skids, and the Harriers mostly stay in the boat, but that's another story. We took two nose wheels off of, one off of 46, one off 53. We flipped over a Huey. Untold other ripped the skids off another Copra, things of that nature. And one of the big improvements is teaching people, you know, V-22's always had a certain level of automation in this, but it's improved over time so that now that we can, for example, set up an automated hover. Depending on what type of insert you're doing, establish a hover at a certain altitude, and then it will stabilize it for you there, and then all you have to do is pull the power back and land straight down. So that takes a lot of the difficulty level out of, you know, in my opinion, is probably one of the most difficult things in aviation, which is landing without being able to see the ground, which happens all the time. And that's one feature that we've, you know, tried to exploit the inherent fly-by-wire aspects of the aircraft to be able to automate that process a lot more than most of our other helicopters or rotorcraft. So I think that alone saves, you know, we've lost way more helicopters by rolling over in the dust than we ever have by being shot at. So by taking that number of losses down, I think is a huge thing. You know, one of the other things is, you know, exploiting that in-air refueling capability, teaming up with a C-130 and be able to either stay aloft a lot longer or go a lot further. So you see now, you know, the first Iraq aircraft are taken over by sea, but the ones that are going to the special purpose MACTAP in Spain, those are being flown there with aerial refueling. So that's exploiting that inherent capability of the aircraft. You know, a couple other things, you know, being able to use the all-weather capability. It's a much better instrument platform than a traditional rotorcraft, so you're able to use different techniques to get through weather a lot better and still have a section or division of aircraft together on the other side of that bad weather so you can still do your insert, things like that.
Let me first apologize for cutting out earlier. Some technical issue involving a switch in the wrong position. As you look forward here in the next few months or so, what are you planning to write some more articles relative to the topics you've raised and the ones you've already written? Or are you going to do more work with the with leadership? Where do you go from here?
Well, the professional writing thing has always been kind of an interest of mine. Before I've written probably 4 or 5 articles for the Marine Corps Gazette. And I started doing the first couple probably 7-8 years ago now, talking about aviation issues and more like MOS or specialty type of issues about aviation. And as I've gone on, I've got the writing bug a little bit, so you know, I wrote for Proceedings, that one article. Originally it was for the leadership essay contest, but didn't win that, so I published under the normal guidelines. And now I've been starting to write for the Task and Purpose publication, and I pretty much got, I guess you'd say, a monthly gig writing a piece a month for them. And I still like to write about aviation. That's kind of my passion, I guess, but also trying to write for, you know, the broader audience, you know, the leadership and military culture pieces, and also, you know, some, you know, political, military, security issues in general, kind of branching out into that, you know, because as I get ready to transition from the service, you know, like try to maintain that interest and still be a voice on those issues outside as well as inside the military.
Well, I left the active duty 5 years ago, and I'm still chatting on the subject, so don't feel bad if you can't let go. And, you know, my 2 cents with, and you hit it right there, is, you know, find what you have a passion about and write it, and I think you'll be better, and also the audience will be better as well. I definitely want to see you keep writing. We need more people out there, more ideas out there floating around in the ether. And I wanted to come back. You know, you talked about your leadership essay, and whether deserved or not, he with the shortest hair is assumed to have better leadership training and skills, and people always talk about Marine Corps leadership, and, well, the best general officer, flag officer I ever worked for, really worked with, he didn't own paper on me, was a Marine. But when we look at what we originally were talking about, is that sense of excess entitlement that we can have, not only by those that are wearing the uniform, but those that may have retired, whether after full service or just a few years, that ultimately, if that is a problem and it's something that needs correcting, it's something that we in the military, we that have those funny-looking ID cards, that we're going to have to fix it internally inside our culture and perhaps with a little bit of peer counseling and redirecting where required. What are some of your ideas on what we can do for those that are active duty, retired, or just veterans who have served, who run into situations where one of their peers is making a nuisance of themselves, for lack of a better phrase? Are there some tools or ideas you think might be helpful, or is that something that we just need to shrug our shoulders and just not participate in?
Well, I think obviously, like every cop out in the military, it's situationally dependent, as we say. But
sure.
To give some more concrete things, I mean, if it's an entitlement type issue, obviously there's a just chill out, we can take care of this in a more rational way if someone really starts to lose it. But I tend to think, one, the first thing before you start doing anything else is, one, be that good example. And two, you see someone starting to go off the reservation, whether that's in the entitlement realm or a conduct realm, if there's a situation out of hand, it's your duty to take care of it. It's really going crazy. But I think the first step as a leader is, one, step back and just have a little bit of empathy. Try and see it through the other person's eyes for a second and see where they're coming from with it. Because, there are people who have legitimate gripes. So first seek to understand and then to be understood. And if you look at it, what's this guy really looking for? Is this just pure, misconduct that needs to be handled as such? Or is there a situation that this guy, it's a legitimate situation, but he's just handling it in the wrong way? And if the second one, try and get that person aside and say, hey, I know this is what you want, whether it's that discount or whatever it is, but you're not going about it in a way that's, one, effective, or two, reflecting well on us as an institution. And, I think this is what you're trying to get at, but, can I offer this to you? So I think that's the first step in correcting a situation is, one, try and see that through the other person's eyes for a second and see whether that's a reasonable thing, and then go from there.
Your article in Proceedings about the kids are all right, which really caught my attention because it's a pretty good piece. Are the kids all right? Are they going to be all right in the future? And can we stop Dan from meeting too?
Unless we mess them up, that's the thing. It's we put all these negative associations with them, and I go on at length in the piece, but it's sort of. The thing that brought that particular piece to me was hearing a Marine colonel's retirement remarks to all the officers in his command, and basically in the good old days, the Marines did what we told them to, blah, blah, blah. And, it really sort of struck a nerve with me, and I think the Marine Corps in particular, and probably the Navy, suffers from this as well. And I think it's partially a media thing, because everything they do wrong is broadcast on Facebook and Twitter and every news outlet there is much more quickly. But I think it's a failure of putting ourselves in their shoes. These kids, by every objective standard, are better than the ones that came before. Whether you look at your ASVAB scores, we say they're discipline problems, but if you actually looked at the Army, Navy, and Marine court-martial statistics, numbers of court martials have gone down consistently for the last several years. So either it's they're not doing things wrong, or our leaders don't have the courage to court martial people who are. So that's the leadership's problem, not the Marine or the sailor's problem. So the idea that they're, some lesser quality. Now, do they have different cultural things going on? Yeah, of course. But, the kids in the 2010s are different than the ones in the 90s, which are different than the ones in the 70s and the 50s and so forth. That doesn't mean they're better or worse. It just means they're different. So, if you allow them to bring their talents to the table and exploit them, you're going to get good performance on them. They're doing great things. And that's the contradiction. Our leadership says that, it's great hyperbole how great our sailors and Marines are doing in combat, so forth and so on. But then they come right back and say, oh, but their conduct is horrible and we need more duties, more this, more that. Either their job is to do well in combat. That's the bottom line. And then we go from there. So I think we do ourselves a disservice by underestimating them. And then we basically try and smash them into a certain mold. we're not, you know, not fully utilizing their talents.
I'm really glad that Eagle One brought up that article. I enjoyed it as well, and I'm with you 100%. There's nothing wrong with the millennial generations now. Their leadership, you can address that issue. Then everything else will work itself out just fine. But I'll tell you what, Carl, I really enjoyed the visit. And again, everybody, if you haven't had a chance to read his article, just Google Unpacking the Veteran Entitlement Spectrum, or you can find that link over on the show page or on my home blog. And he's got a lot of other things out there worth reading, including that article about the kids are all right. Thanks for taking an hour with us. Really appreciate it, Carl.
No, it's been my pleasure. I hope to do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks, Carl.
Got it. And thank you very much for joining us for an hour and a half. We'll be back next week at our normal time. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy and Marine Corps day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.